Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. This installment of Secure Freedom Radio is going to be particularly important to those of you who are still trying to get your head around the fact that the free world is under assault, and from the various sources of threats and dangers to our freedoms and to our country. Few people are better equipped to help us understand all of this and have done more, really, both in government and for the past few decades in the private sector and as a leader in the academic battle space than our guest for this full hour. His name is Dr. John Linchowski. I had the privilege of working with John a lifetime ago in the Reagan administration, where he served, among other things, in the Department of State as a special advisor to the Undersecretary for Political Affairs, and not least, as the Director of European and Soviet Affairs at the National Security Council under President Ronald Reagan. He was, among other things, a prime mover behind the efforts that President Reagan undertook to destroy the principal enemy to the free world at the time, namely Soviet communism. John Linchowski is the author of countless essays and articles and several very important books, including Soviet Perceptions of U.S. Foreign Policy and the Sources of Soviet Perestroika. His most recent book is Full Spectrum Diplomacy and Grand Strategy. We'll be talking about its contents throughout the course of this program. I'm so appreciative that an old friend and valued colleague is willing to give us a full hour of his time. And John Linchowski, thank you for doing so. Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. It is an honor to be with you, and let me just express my appreciation to you for the extraordinary and persistent work that you've done for the protection of our country and of, indeed, the free world. And I'm really delighted to be part of this.
Well, you have been part of it from the get-go, notably in your important capacity as the founder and driving force behind one of the most important institutions of higher learning in the United States. It's called the Institute of World Politics. And John has literally taken that from scratch to a formidable academic institution delivering high-quality graduate-level education to people who are going on with regularity now to senior positions in the government, in the intelligence community, and elsewhere. And John, I can't tell you how proud I am of the work that you've done. So thank you for indulging me in this mutual admiration society. It's so good to be able to do it with you. But listen, let's talk just for starters, John, about this free world business. I think, you know, we look around us and particularly people coming out of most of the rest of academia these days seem to have very little appreciation about freedom. It's taken for granted. It's often rather strongly demeaned, indeed, by younger people and some older ones as well. So just help us level set on this, John. What, in your experience and your assessment professionally, is the free world, and what distinguishes it from the rest of the places around the globe?
Well, Frank, I consider the free world to be that collection of countries that is characterized by a number of different elements of what we consider to be the the political systems that have dominated principally Western civilization for a very long time. And these are countries with legitimate governments where the criterion for legitimacy is the consent of the governed, where there is the rule of law rather than the rule, the capricious and arbitrary rule of those who happen to be in power, where there is some sense in the structure of government about the flawed nature of man and the fact that we need to set up our public institutions in a way that protect society from the inevitable corruptions to which some of our leaders will inevitably succumb. So we have our system of diffusion of power, of separation of powers, of checks and balances, of a constitutional law that can be a standard of law that is higher than the statutory laws that can be oftentimes passed by legislatures in a fit of passion and that sometimes turn out to be unjust laws. And then I believe that ultimately there has to be a higher law even than our Constitution. I believe that you simply cannot have a system, for example, like ours, of majority rule with inalienable minority rights if those rights are endowed by a majority, because there can be some things, such a thing as the tyranny of the majority. And so there has to be, you know, you can have interpretations of our Constitution that can permit slavery. You can pass a law and actually amend the Constitution to permit slavery. But does that make it just? It doesn't. And so all of this is a political system that produces political and economic freedom. It permits freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, and you know, I consider this to be really the Greco-Roman Judeo-Christian civilization. And there are and it's characterized actually by one of the great features that was given to us by the ancient Hebrew people, namely the capacity to look at our past sins, to atone for them, and then to try to engage in self-improvement. And now, not every, you know, this is a function of Western civilization, and there are actually civilizations elsewhere in the world that don't particularly have that last attribute. But nevertheless, insofar as they give their people political and economic freedom, they are indeed part of the free world. And unfortunately, too many of us in the United States and throughout the West and elsewhere take those freedoms for granted.
We have to pause. When we come back, we're going to talk about people who would like to take those freedoms away altogether, particularly enemies foreign. We'll get around to the enemies domestic as well. With Dr. John Linchowski of the Institute for World Politics. Stay tuned for much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Dr. John Linchowski. He is one of the country's foremost experts on Russia, the Soviet Union before that, a man who has done incalculable good, to my way of thinking, on behalf of the American people and freedom more generally, notably during his time working for our beloved former boss and President Ronald Reagan, who set about trying to defeat the threat to freedom and the free world that Soviet communism represented. And John played not a small part in the execution of his strategy. I think of it as best enshrined in National Security Decision Directive 75, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in due course. But John, first, again, in the interest of sort of getting this scene set properly, what is it about Russia, whether it was under the Tsars or whether it's under the Soviets or whether it's now under Putin, that has made them sort of viscerally hostile to the sorts of freedoms of which you spoke so eloquently a moment ago, and the civilization and societies and world built upon them?
Well, it's a very good question, Frank. There are many strands that are part of the explanation to answer your question. I believe that part of it has very much to do with Russian history and the fact that Russia never went through what we did in the West. It never went through feudalism. The Renaissance, the Reformation, the Counter-Reformation, the Scottish Enlightenment, and just in the case of feudalism, for example, one could argue that feudalism is one of the most progressive things that ever happened to the ordinary man in the course of the development of history. This is why the Magna Carta is so important, which was the great document from medieval times, where the nobles declared their rights against the king, their property rights and political rights, and Russia never went through this. The Tsar owned everybody and everything, and so people, of course, most of Russia grew out not so much out of Kievan Rus as it grew out of Muscovy. And particularly because the Muscovites were serving as the local agents of the Mongol Khan, and the Muscovite elite would literally go back to the Khan's court and serve as his footstool and learned about Oriental despotism from those particular precincts. And so you have a completely different type of political culture that developed over the centuries, and try as Peter the Great might have done to bring about some westernization in the course of Russian history. There never was a real tradition of enjoying any kind of political or economic liberty. And so then on top of this this history, you had the catastrophe of communism. And what we're seeing today is the heirs, in a way, of the Czechist tradition. The Czechists, of course, were the original KGB men. And the secret police who were part of the entire internal security system of that state, the counterintelligence state, the Gulag state. And what you have today is that about 70% or more of the Russian elite are people who basically come out of that secret police culture. And these people are deeply resentful of the loss of Soviet superpower status. You very well know that Putin declared that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest political catastrophe of the 20th century.
Which is really saying something, isn't it, given what else went on, World War I, World War II, for example.
Yes. So he has a revanchist agenda to try to restore Russian greatness as a superpower. And he believes that this is best achieved by trying to stymie the influence of the United States and the West in general in virtually most of our various foreign policy initiatives.
Yeah, John Linchowski, let me ask you, because Vladimir Putin has, of course, held forth in the course of the day today at length, as is his wont, on his end-of-year press conference about the various things that are wrong with the West or what it is doing. You mentioned foreign policies, for example. Notably, he blamed the United States for creating conditions that likely to lead to an arms race with respect to intermediate range nuclear forces. Now, he seemed to ignore the reason that the United States is contemplating putting some kind of capabilities in this sort of category of weapons in place again, namely that the Russians have violated the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that we were involved in negotiating back in the day under President Reagan. I just am struck by this kind of penchant for disinformation on the one hand, of course, but also distortion to justify the revanchism, to justify the aggression even that we've seen quite a bit of, notably in Georgia, Ukraine, of course, you might argue in the Middle East, certainly threats against the Baltics and more generally against Europe. John Linchowski, as you look at Putin as the current, you know, sort of inheritor of and promulgator of Russian, Soviet, Russian policies towards the free world, do you see him as a present danger, or is this mostly, you know, bluster without much real danger associated with it?
Well, I believe that he is a dangerous. I don't think he is an existential threat to the United States, but I think that he could produce so much mischief and so much damage around the periphery of the West that it could produce a potentially very dangerous situations. I believe that the origin of a lot of his behavior is the fact that he has a legitimacy problem. Most of the ways he got into power, his original appointment, his original elections and re-elections, are all highly suspect. I believe that he launched the Second Chechen War as a way of basically bolstering his legitimacy, and he's been working on this great Russian chauvinist agenda of his as a way precisely of trying to maintain his own internal security. He wants to get the Russian people to feel as though they're part of something great again, and he is pushing around the periphery. There is the cyber invasion of Estonia. There was the divide and conquer strategy, splitting the Abkhaz and the Ossetians away from Georgia and then invading Georgia. There is the invasion of Ukraine. There is his subversion and in many of the countries around the Russia's periphery. And all of this could potentially cross the threshold of what is strategically acceptable to the United States and NATO. And so we need to be maintaining a very strong deterrent. I believe that he and the Russians can be deterred. Deterrence works, but we have to be seen as being serious. And that's what they respect. And we need to have a permanent military presence on the eastern flank of NATO. Germany was the eastern flank at one time during the Cold War. Now that boundary has moved further east. These are sovereign countries. Russia has been meddling in their internal affairs, trying to subvert them in any number of ways, trying to get the whole region and all of Europe dependent upon them and ultimately vulnerable to their energy blackmail. And so it's a very clear-cut job of what we need to do to maintain the strength of the NATO alliance and maintain our proper military deterrent And then not to have any illusions about arms control, because the Russians have violated every one of the agreements they sign. They even have a strategy to violate them, which is what the arms control industry in this town seems to completely ignore. They even develop propaganda campaigns on how to respond to public charges of treaty violations. And they develop those propaganda campaigns even before they sign the treaties that they are strategizing to violate. Yes.
Well, look, I would just say of that industry, John, having spent a lot of time, as you have, combating it, that it is essentially in thrall, if not an agent of influence for this very strategy that you're talking about on the part of the Russians. And I would just say, John, you've touched on something that's a very central premise of mine, and that is that the Russians, and for that matter, the Chinese and others who we are now confronting, generally do respect power, but they have a contempt for people who don't have it, and they have an even more intense contempt for people who have strength, have power. We'll talk about that with Dr. John Lunchowski right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back for the third installment of this extraordinarily interesting and really quite important conversation with one of the heroes, to my way of thinking, of Cold War 1.0, that with the Soviet Union, John Lunchowski, as a senior advisor to President Ronald Reagan, was one of those who helped engineer the defeat of the USSR, as it was called at the time, and the liberation of hundreds of millions of people from the tyranny of communism, one of the most important developments in the history of the free world. One that we need to be, I think, learning from at the present moment, because according to the Chinese, going back to Deng Xiaoping in, I believe, 1991, we now find ourselves in another Cold War with another adversary, this one Communist China. John, I've had the privilege of being in several settings where you have held forth at some length about your concerns about what the Chinese are up to and the implications for the free world in general, but the United States in particular. And I invite you to do so now. Tell us more about your thinking on that subject.
Thank you, Frank. I believe that China is the existential threat that we face today. And this is going to be the first time since 1812 that the United States faces a hostile power with an economy that will be bigger than ours, if it isn't already. The Chinese have been conducting a Cold War against the United States for a very long time, and nobody seems to have wanted to notice it, to say anything about it, because large segments of the of American elites have been successfully politically neutralized by the Chinese, most especially large segments of the American business community, which thought that it could make lots of money by selling a single piece of chewing gum to every single one of the 1.5 billion Chinese, and that was going to be the answer. Well, the Chinese have been, as we know, and finally we have a president who has stopped censoring himself about these matters. They have been stealing our intellectual property, our industrial secrets, and our military secrets. It is breathtaking what they have stolen. It is the greatest theft of intellectual property in the history of the world. They are taking our military technologies and in many cases deploying them even faster than we can deploy some of them. They have developed all kinds of things, anti-ship ballistic missiles, the neutron bomb, anti-satellite weapons. They have tested their lasers to blind our satellites, which is what they did in 2007.
Blind our pilots, too, by the way.
Yes, and lasing our pilots, yes. They have done some very nasty and unneighborly things, like, for example, try to send AK-47s to Los Angeles street gangs, and U.S. Customs stopped that. And they then managed to catch the Chinese trying to send Stinger missile knockoffs. In other words, shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missile knockoffs to the same Los Angeles street gangs. We stopped that and managed to trace it to very high levels in the Chinese government.
And then there's fentanyl that they are depositing in this country in enormous quantities that's killing people left and right.
And their police state can surely figure out who is going down to the post office with boxes of fentanyl to send to us, to here, or to send to Latin America so that it'll be smuggled over the border. The Chinese used narcotics as a weapon of war during the Korean War. Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet Communist Party leader in the 50s, was so impressed by the Chinese action of using narcotics as a weapon of war that he replicated this project, but in a thing that he called the code name Druzhba Narodov, the friendship of the peoples. But he got the satellite countries to be doing the narcotics rather than directly the KGB, because it's better that a proxy be caught doing some dirty work than the KGB directly. The Chinese have about 50,000 spies or so in the United States. Large numbers of people, everybody from visiting businessmen to Chinese graduate students at MIT and Caltech and Georgia Tech and Virginia Tech and all of these places. American universities are now addicted to Chinese students because they pay full tuition.
And the Chinese Confucius Institutes, similarly, funding streams for American academics?
At least 100 of these. And these are ostensibly centers for the study of Chinese language and culture, but in fact they are propaganda centers that are subject to, they're controlled by the Chinese, not by us, and they are subjected to Chinese communist speech codes. Meanwhile, we have only about 20 American cultural centers in China, and those are controlled by the Chinese rather than us. We give a disproportionate number of visas, over 800 visas, to Chinese propagandists who come here in the guise of being journalists, whereas they give two visas to government-sponsored journalists from The Voice of America. They won't give us a third for a correspondent in Shanghai. That would be just a little too much. The thing that perhaps you're mentioning of the Confucius Institutes is the tip of an iceberg when it comes to their political influence operations and propaganda and disinformation in the United States. Our main newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, take millions of dollars from the Chinese propaganda ministry in order to publish the China Watch supplement.
These are advertising inserts that appear inside the pages of these newspapers and thereby get audiences and legitimacy, don't they, that they certainly don't deserve.
Exactly. And I don't know how much these are, 8 to 12 page inserts full of Chinese propaganda. But what really influences people is what these newspapers do not report about China, which has something to do with what I've been talking about.
The fact that they're taking money from the Chinese.
That's right. I have identified the four taboos that American journalists and American experts, academic experts on China, will not touch. The first is Chinese human rights violations. The second is the Chinese military buildup. The third is Chinese espionage. And the fourth is Chinese political influence operations and subversion in the United States. And nobody will talk about any of this stuff. And if our national leaders don't talk about it, we will continue to be in a state of semi-anesthetization. I say semi because this president has finally started to tell the truth about some of the espionage.
Well, and about trade and about intellectual property theft and expressing concerns about the military buildup and the operations in the South China Sea and so on. So I think to a degree that we've not seen since Ronald Reagan's time, in fairness, John Linchowski, Donald Trump is taking a stand against a totalitarian threat that is on the march. And the question is it enough? Is it, in point of fact, going to effectively challenge, let alone decisively defeat, the kind of threat that we're now observing from China and that we're likely to see a lot more of? And John, I guess one other thing I just would ask you to do to tie all this together, we're going to come back in a moment to what we should be doing about threats from China and Russia and the Islamists and so on. But just very quickly, one of the ways in which this is evidently not just an accident, comrade, as the communists like to say, but the purposeful design of the Chinese communist to supplant the United States as the world's dominant power is embedded in what Xi Jinping calls the China Dream. And his plan for bringing about Made in China 2025 and the Belt and Road Initiative and so much more that is clearly driving the economic warfare to take down our industrial base and to build up their military and finance both on us and so on. So could you just say a word about what the ambition is? You talked a little bit about Putin's in the past, but talk a little bit about Xi's.
The Chinese communists want to dominate the world. They have a global strategy. They are cornering natural resource markets all over the place. They have a massive global energy acquisition strategy. They have a demographic and infrastructural presence at just about every one of the strategic naval choke points in the world, whether it is the Strait of Malacca, the Strait of Hormuz, the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, the Suez Canal, the Dardanelles, the Panama Canal. They are in all of these places. And it's an extraordinary vision that they have. And I believe that so much of this is driven to a very large extent, once again, by the systemic requirements of an illegitimate regime, where they have to show their own people that they are so powerful that nobody can stop them in their global ambitions.
John, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with a final segment with John Linchowski right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our final segment of a fascinating conversation with Dr. John Linchowski, the president and founder of the Institute of World Politics. John, we've covered a lot of ground very quickly. I did want to do the same with another topic, which we could easily spend an hour on. I'm looking at a testimony that you provided to the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee back in June of 2017 about the war of ideas against radical Islamism, as you call it. You make a very strong case in this that fundamentally what we're up against is a totalitarian ideology cast in a sort of religious garb of Islam, but it's, I think, more accurate to describe it as sort of a Sharia supremacist agenda. And you argue for a counter-ideological approach to dealing with it. Talk us through that, if you would, quickly.
Yes, Frank. We have spent trillions of dollars in two major wars that were sparked by the terrorist attacks of 9/11. I like to say that this is akin to inviting all your friends over to a garden party, giving them all shotguns, and say, we're going to get rid of the mosquitoes in my backyard. And you shoot up the backyard and for a few hours, and you'll get a bunch of mosquitoes. But the problem is that there's a puddle in the backyard where something is going on, and it is the recruitment of new mosquitoes. And we haven't been paying any attention to that puddle. And what we need to be doing is we need to be preventing terrorists from becoming terrorists in the first place. And so that's just one part of the whole challenge. And of course, this is a question of strategic communications, of a war of ideas that is one going on principally within Islam itself, because there are those in Islam who believe that they should go and slaughter all of the infidels and so on and so forth. But then there are those who say that you don't do this kind of slaughter without proper just war justifications. And of course, very few people are aware of that kind of just war dimension that exists within within Islam, and yet this is part of this war of ideas. And there are many messages that have to be sent to people who contemplate being terrorists. You have to let them know that they're not going to go to heaven and meet 72 virgins, that they are going to burn in hell, and they understand that. You have to let them know that if, for example, ISIS is defeated, maybe that was Allah's will that ISIS has lost 99% of its territory, because after all, Allah wills everything, doesn't he? There are all sorts of messages that are part of this war of ideas. There's another part of this whole struggle, though, and that is that terrorism isn't simply the only threat from Islam. It is Sharia supremacism, as you so eloquently have documented and analyzed for many years. And a lot of this in radical Islamism involves the supercharging, the turbocharging of dawah, which is the process of immigration for proselytization purposes, where separatist enclaves are being set up in many Western countries, no-go zones, which our elites in this country deny the existence of such no-go zones. But you can go buy an app for your iPhone that tells you whether you're entering such a thing in Paris, for example. In any event, these separatist enclaves are Sharia-run enclaves where Sharia has begun to penetrate the legal systems of a number of countries in Europe. And yet this is something that is completely inconsistent with the Constitution of the United States. And we have to be very careful about whom we admit to this country. And if you want to get a visa to this country, you have to ask questions about whether you have ever worked with the Nazis or the communists. There should be another question in there as to whether or not you are in favor of Sharia.
In fact, we did an amicus brief before the Supreme Court in connection with the idea of limiting immigration from jihadist countries to exactly that point, John Lanchowski. And I think it's so important, as is the larger effort to counter this ideology through the various information systems that we have. And that brings me to really the closing question here, John. You've given a chilling portrait of assorted adversaries who seem determined to take down the free world. Harkening back, as I think we both do, to what President Reagan did to wage effectively a countervailing strategy against one such regime, that of the Soviet Union, again, National Security Decision Directive 75 being one succinct expression of his strategy, what would you recommend Donald Trump do now, whether it's vis-a-vis Russia or China or these Islamists, to bring in a similar fashion all instruments of national power to bear to defend ourselves and others who share our love of freedom?
Yes. The first thing, of course, is that we cannot be perceived by all of these adversaries as weak. And that means, of course, having material strength military strength, the revival of our economy, and all of that. But material factors are all in vain if we do not have, first of all, the internal moral cultural health that is necessary. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the great Russian author, said that security does not come from nuclear umbrellas. It comes from stout hearts and steadfast men. And that means a kind of a political, moral, ideological strength, a strength of conviction in the values and principles by which you run your civilization. Our academic institutions in this country have been undermining that cultural strength for a very long time. We do not teach the political philosophy underlying the founding of our country. A major study discovered that college freshmen know more about civics than college seniors do. And that doesn't even concern other things having to do with what is necessary to maintain a free society. A free society has to have self-governing people, and self-governing people have to be people capable of controlling themselves. And as the ancient historian Livy once said, one sure way of defeating your enemy is to spread amongst his population the ideas of selfishness and hedonism, because when their enemies see that you are a selfish, pleasure-seeking people, that's when you are at a state of maximum vulnerability.
Yeah, well, I agree with that. And the march through our institutions, you know, the cultural Marxist march through our institutions has been all about fostering precisely not just that perception, but that condition, hasn't it? So beyond trying to sort of exhibit and practice peace through strength, John Lunchowski, are there other things that specifically need to be done, particularly in this important two-year window?
I call it winning without war. And this is where we use the instruments of information, strategic communications, our ideals of human rights and respect for the dignity of the human person, where we fight the war of ideas. Look, for example, at how do we deal with China? Today, our greatest allies in the Cold War against China are the Chinese people, and we have to connect with them. They live under a totalitarian circumstances.
Becoming more so by the day with this so-called social credit score business, right?
Yes, yes. And these people are the totalitarian rule requires the atomization of society. That means separating everybody from everybody else by creating an atmosphere of fear and mistrust, where you don't know who is an informant, and yet the informants are everywhere. And when people are atomized, they cannot ally with one another to create cells of resistance. And so we have to communicate with them. We have to make sure that they feel as though they're not alone. We have to stand up for their human rights.
I'm so grateful to you, John, for your service to our country, both that you performed in the Reagan administration, notably when we had a chance to serve together, and that, of course, that you have performed in the decades since. Keep coming back to us, John, if you would. I hope we'll have the chance to do the same with you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.